Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Does capitalism make people at the top of the economic pyramid rich, or does it make people at the bottom poor? Some might say the answer is yes to both questions. But if it doesn't work fairly for everybody, why have we protected and refined and celebrated capitalism for centuries? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Raj Patel is research professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University in South Africa. His new book, written with co-author Jason W. Moore, is called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. In it, they explore not just how we got the capitalism we live with today, but why it's created an infrastructure that allows or even requires bad outcomes for people and the environment. Raj Patel joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Raj, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
What makes something cheap for the purposes of this discussion?
Well, so we're talking about seven cheap things, not seven things. And what makes the idea of cheap matter is that cheapness is a strategy. It's a way of squeezing profits out of the various things that we're discussing. It's sort of a tactic, a fix to postpone a sort of final reckoning of the problems that capitalism is accumulating. So cheapness is a way of keeping costs down. I mean, if capitalism has a golden rule, it is never pay your bills. And cheapness is a way of, as I say, sort of squeezing, whether it's what we call nature or labor or a range of other things, to minimize their costs so that profits can accumulate, even if problems accumulate at the same time.
So, like, instead of getting a new roof, we put a piece of plastic over a hole in the roof.
Right. And then when the water comes in, we'll find, you know, if the plastic runs out, maybe we'll hire someone to actually sort of lay their bodies down on the roof. And once they get old, then we'll find some other patch. But it's always a perpetual story of fixes upon fixes upon fixes. And in order for those fixes to ultimately work, you need to expand the boundaries of the range of things that you're using to be able to fix that hole.
So the point that you drive home here is that our relentless embrace of cheapness as a fix has led us to a time in which we're seeing these abrupt and irreversible changes in ecosystems. And this includes, but by no means is limited to, climate change.
Right. I mean, so the first cheap thing and the sort of one that underwrites the story that we're telling is the relationship that humans have with all other kinds of life. And being able to use nature as a resource, the very thinking that nature is something outside us and that we can exploit it ad infinitum, that idea is one that's very specific to capitalism. And the idea that nature is just going to be there for us to mine as a resource and to throw our trash away in, well, that is coming very much home to roost. So, for example, think of the oceans. The last commercial fish catch will be landed, by some estimates, in 2047, 2048, after which commercial fishing in the oceans will be over. So we've assumed that the oceans are going to be there as a bounty forever. But just as we treat the oceans as a place of infinite resources that we can mine, it's also true that we treat the oceans as an infinite trash heap. And that's why by 2050, there will be more plastic in the sea than fish. And so that relationship to the environment, to what we understand as the environment, the natural world outside us, is one that has resulted in things like climate change. Sure, we can take the carbon from the soil, or we can take the fossil fuel, burn it, and just throw the trash into the air, and it'll be fine. But the consequences of that are very much coming home to roost.
So this history of capitalism focuses largely on European influence on global culture, which at first might sound like a narrow Eurocentric field of view, but you include this extraordinary map of all the places that are or have been controlled, colonized, partially colonized, or existed within the sphere of influence of Europe. There are literally just like a few tiny specks on the global map that have not been under European influence.
And I think that that's important to remember. It is an accident of fate and of climate and of circumstance that capitalism develops in Europe. But because of capitalism being the system that it is, it's not an accident that capitalism needs colonies. As you say, other than Japan and Liberia and Thailand, there are very, very few places that haven't been fully colonized by Europe. And that drive to colonialism may seem like very old. It may seem like an artifact of history. But actually, it's bang up to date. I mean, if you listen to the news, you listen to Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk and their dreams of saving the planet. And when you listen a little more closely, you hear Jeff Bezos, for example, talking about wanting to get to the moon to be able to open it up as a new frontier of enterprise. And when you hear of Elon Musk's plans to visit Mars, they're not to visit and say hello, they're to colonize. And that impulse of capitalism to colonize and the need to colonize is something that, you know, when we started writing this book, we hadn't really identified as something that was a live issue. But as we were writing the book, every day we saw more and more examples of the colonial frontier not just being pushed out to encompass the entire planet, but now beyond the planet. I mean, I was reading the Financial Times a few weeks ago, and there was a special supplement on space mining. That only makes sense when you understand capitalism in the way that we're presenting it here.
All right. How did the feudal system arise in Europe, and in what ways did it really set up to be the precursor of modern capitalism?
Well, so feudalism arises in a particularly propitious time. The climate is warm and kind to crops in a span of 300 or so years, known as the medieval warm period, or the medieval climate anomaly. And so for a while in Europe, feudal lords have great weather. And their way of managing that and of maximizing the output for them and for their societies is to make sure that peasants stick on the land and start working. And the weather kind of helps coax more and more out of the soil. But by the end of feudalism, a number of things are going wrong. First of all, the climate anomaly has ended. And so feudalism ends in a period of turbulent climate change. But it's not just climate change, but also the Black Death, which scythes through Europe and decimates, really destroys the agricultural base of European feudal society. So you have this strange combination of a social system that depends on cheap, on peasants, and on good weather, and both of those things disappear. In the turbulent time that follows, there are a number of experiments that crop up. Feudal peasants say, look, actually, if you give us the means to control our land, we can get way more out of this land than if we just follow what the Lord tells us to do. And some studies suggest that the peasants would have been able to get three times as much out of the land as had they followed the strictures of their feudal lords. But the trouble is that the lords were reluctant to let go of power, and they fought back. And one of the experiments that emerges out of Portugal, and it emerges through the experiments of colonialism. And they are so remunerative, they are so profitable, that soon the idea of European sort of colonial exploits becomes the way in which a new system sustains itself, very different from feudalism, one that's always looking for profit and looking to expand. And that's the story of how feudalism, through a series of experiments, some of which might have yielded a very different kind of system, finally lands on capitalism. Capitalism was an accident that emerges out of turbulent climate change, through disease, and through peasant uprising, and through lords taking the reins and imposing fairly brutal justice on those who would imagine a different system.
You had this early cash crop in sugar, of all things.
Well, so this is interesting. I mean, we're looking for examples that can tell a story of how capitalism emerges. And one of the first cash crops is sugar. And the story unfolds on the island of Madeira off the coast of Africa. It's colonized by the Portuguese, and initially they use the lumber for ships and for construction. But then they realize, hey, what we can do is clear cut the forest. We can engage in some complex hydrological engineering. We can make the fresh water come down to these areas that then we will plant sugarcane on. And they develop these ideas, and they take these ideas from the Middle East, where some of these technologies had been practiced. But the Portuguese are able to bring not just complex hydrological engineering, but also slaves and high finance to try and transform the island into a place that can get cheap sugar or make sugar available in bulk and much more cheaply than elsewhere to send and to sell to Europe. And so it's a story that involves not just a rearranging of production. You know, it's really the first sort of massive factory. Madeira, an entire island, becomes a factory for sugar. But in order for that sugar to work, and for that factory to work, you need a lot of energy. And so part of the story of Madeira, the island of wood, is what it means. And that wood is destroyed within about 75 years. All the trees are chopped down to use for fuel to be able to turn sugarcane into sugar that then can be sold to Europe. And so that's why Madeira is kind of exhibit A for us in showing how it is that capitalism needs to expand and needs to find these new frontiers and is innovative in new and productive ways, but is entirely destructive of the land on which it finds itself. And it depends on all of these inputs. And then once it's discarded Madeira, Madeira is left as a place that's used for the transshipment of slaves across the Atlantic. And some people may have heard of Madeira wine. And in fact, grapes are what are then grown on Madeira. But in order for that wine to be matured, there aren't any trees left for the casks. Hmm. And so the casks have to be imported from the New World. So the trees for the casks for Madeira don't come from Madeira anymore. They don't come from the island of wood because there's no wood left to use to turn into casks.
Explain to me, if you can, why capitalism has made work cheap. It would seem that work would be more valuable in a system that requires people to at least be compliant enough to do the work required of them to earn their salary.
But I think, Chris, you're putting your finger on the point that what you need is compliance. And capitalism has a long history of getting that compliance in one form or another without actually paying people, or at least paying people their full wage. So while we can talk about Madeira, for example, and we can talk about the sort of layers of slavery, and then there are some workers who are paid a pittance, and then there are some entrepreneurs who are paid well, the people who are involved in the shipping of sugar from Madeira to the rest of Europe, people like Christopher Columbus, when he was Captain Columbus, he was paid for his work. But I mean, if you want to see what that layer cake of exploitation looks like, then look to the cell phone in your hand or in your pocket. That cell phone is the product of a range of things. I mean, there is people at the very top of the cell phone food chain who are paid very, very well. And then there are coders who are to some extent exploiting themselves, but they're not doing too badly. But if they work at the headquarters of some tech firm, then around them will be janitors and workers who are part of the infrastructure of that facility who are paid badly. And then you have the workers who put the phone together who are paid very, very badly. Mm. And we've seen the sort of Foxconn stories. And then beneath that, you have workers who are sometimes not paid at all, like the workers who are involved in coltan mining in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And in order for these products to be able to work well, you depend on that kind of bottom-rate slavery. And so that layer cake of exploitation, slavery, and richness, it's an old story, but it's a very new one, too.
My guest is Raj Patel, research professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT and author of the new book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Raj Patel, who is Senior Research Associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University and also Research Professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT. His new book is called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Okay, Raj, I want to talk a little bit more about the relationship between cheap work, which you just mentioned, and cheap lives or slavery.
Well, so this is a very troubling development, Chris, that in fact, as the book went to press, we heard of the International Labour Organization released a new report in which they chronicled that 40 million people today are victims of modern slavery. So 25 million people in forced labor and 15 million people in forced marriage. Just to put that into perspective, the transatlantic slave trade in its entirety involved 25 million people in that heinous episode of the founding of this country. But that cheap work is, and the idea that certain people are beyond the pale, that certain people's lives are disposable. That idea is very much with us. And so the idea of cheap lives, I think, is very sort of mixed and very related to the idea of cheap nature. So let's revisit this. For something to be considered cheap nature, it sits on the other side of a boundary, a very strange boundary. There have always been civilizations, human civilizations, that use what we call the natural world, right? Every human civilization has had a relationship to other plants and animals and used them in different ways. But capitalism is different because capitalism has a very odd relationship because it's only in understanding. I mean, capitalism has this strange binary. The opposite of nature in capitalism is society.
Hmm.
And that binarism is unlike any other human civilization that we know. So to be a member of society on the one hand is to be to have these virtues of civilization, and very importantly, not to be wild, not to be understood as, again, beyond the pale. But when I use that term, beyond the pale, and in fact, I'm curious, Chris, whether it's something that gets used a lot in the United States. But in Britain, when we have this idea of beyond the pale, it's people who are sort of savage and strange and unusual. But the history of this idea of beyond the pale, of someone who's beyond the pale, comes from a very real moment in British colonialism and English colonialism, when the English colonized Ireland. And the fence that separated the English colony from the savage Irish was called the Pale. And so those beyond the Pale were naturally understood as part of nature, as opposed to part of civilization. And so to have cheap lives is, in a sense, to be the product of a lot of education and a lot of infrastructure that makes other people's lives seem trivially cheap compared to our own. And so that's the story we're telling.
This, of course, has also allowed for really the marginalization of work that is historically done by women, which has affected the way women have been able to move through society for centuries.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's important that when the International Labour Organization says that there are 40 million slaves and observes that 15 million are in forced marriage. In fact, the majority of modern day slaves, 71%, are women or girls. So again, it's not new. And again, other civilizations have been patriarchal. This is not to blame capitalism for patriarchy, but it is to observe that patriarchy operates in a very particular way in our society. And it works through the invention of things like the household and the invention of the sort of binary relationships, the idea of man and woman, and the idea that it is certain kinds of people who do care work. And the trouble is, of course, that modern capitalism can't operate without that work being done essentially for free. And to give you a sense of how much that is valued at, the United Nations crunched some numbers in 1995. And they said, look, the entire world product in 1995 was $33 trillion. But you can only get that $33 trillion by having $16 trillion of unpaid work, of which $11 trillion was women's unpaid work. So fully a third of all the things that we count when we count GDP are invisibilized and are usually women's work done in order to be able to get that above the line profit figure.
At various times, cheap work, cheap lives have led exploited workers to rise up and demand better. Talk about how capitalism has tried to placate those workers with the cheap fixes that you talked about at the top of the hour.
Well, so one of the things, and you know, we don't have to look very far. I mean, we can look right here to the United States. For the longest time, when we have the data looking at right up to the end of the 19th century, the largest slice of disposable income for urban workers was spent on food. And so part of the way that workers' uprisings were kept in check was by making sure that food was cheap for urban workers. And that story, I think, is one that continues to sort of shape our ideas today. We have this idea, the sort of notion that comes from the world's first paid economist, Thomas Robert Malthus, that if we run out of food, there will be social chaos because populations are increasing and increasing. But that idea itself stems from debates that were happening in the 1700s around the growing urban class of working class in England, and the worries that arose from the fact that their condition was one of great poverty, and the rich were worried about what the poor would do if they ran out of food. I mean, they had examples like the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution to look at and to be worried about. And so one of the ways that the aristocracies and the bourgeoisies in Europe managed to keep workers in check, other than violence and through policing, was by making cheap food available. But in order to do that, they needed to take over large parts of the world. Hmm. So, you know, my ancestors come from Asia. They come from India. And their story was one of absolutely of being growing up and being part of these circuits of providing cheap grain and cheap teas for the English working class, so that the sort of quintessential ideas of tea and bread on which the working class were being raised in Britain were made possible by the work of my ancestors colonized by the British in India.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Dick, calling from Justin. Hey, Dick.
Hello. Is it true that many European countries have a much more social conscience in terms of their governments, and that they will do the kinds of things necessary to keep industries within their country, even though they still maintain a capitalistic system?
Thanks very much, Dick. It's a great question. Part of the reason that Europe looks the way that it does is because of what was seen to be one of the greatest challenges to capitalism, which is communism. Now, in the book, we explain why the Soviet Union wasn't as big a challenge as it appeared. But this fear that, in fact, the Soviet Union was going to take over Europe and that what it was going to impose was a thoroughgoing kind of communism, which it never really had. But that fear made Europe different from the United States. It made it possible for Europe to have welfare states that are very unlike the European one. It made it possible for Europe to engage in certain kinds of protection and investment in industries that for a long time were therefore protected. But these days, the fear of the Soviet Union has disappeared, and Europe is a thoroughgoing. I mean, it's an example of a thoroughgoing sort of scooping out of the industrial base there. And although European labor unions are much stronger than in the United States, and that's one of the reasons why industries are the European industrial base is a little bit more located in Europe. The kind of economic system under which we now live, neoliberalism, is still far advanced in Europe. Nonetheless, there are those social protections in Europe that were a result of The fear that European elites had that if they didn't make compromises in order to protect workers, in order to be able to have things like the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, that workers would take far, far more than just free healthcare, that they would, coming back from the Second World War and weapons trained as they were, they would take much more aggressive steps. And in fact, it's not just in Europe that you see that kind of thing. I mean, the United States was so worried about the spread of communism in China, from China elsewhere, that they were able to do things in South Korea and Japan that looked very communist. They did things like land reform, for instance, and laid the basis for the successful kind of industrial economies that we're seeing in East Asia. But that's because of the fear of what might come when people dreamed something different from capitalism.
It's interesting that many people in Europe are challenging the generosity of the European welfare state like they haven't in the past, at exactly the moment that many countries in Europe are dealing with this influx of refugees from other parts of the world. Is that resistance tied up in the idea of some lives being assigned value by capitalism and some lives being determined to be cheap or worthless?
Oh, that's interesting. The idea of certain kinds of communities and certain kinds of borders having, the idea of a citizen being an entitled entity and cheap work by people who are not citizens being somehow more disposable. Those ideas, I think, flourish in moments when capitalism is in crisis. Let me give you an example. I mean, I'm connected to a country where, there have been, and there is this sort of ongoing environmental crisis and a crisis of work and a crisis of a middle class that really isn't seeing the benefits accruing to it that it sees the super rich getting. And the head of state is a bully on social media and uses the huge social media platform to berate the opposition and to castigate people who are advocates of climate change and to shout from the rooftops at Islamic terrorism is just around the corner. And that country is India. If you think of India now as the kind of the sort of end state of what happens when these sort of rampant ideas of nationalism take hold, India is kind of exhibit A there, because Narendra Modi has, I think, the largest platform on Facebook, and he uses it widely and frequently to control certain kinds of discourse about who is a real Indian and who isn't, and he's very much about sort of pointing out the dangers of Islamic terrorism and using that to goad certain ideas of who's really Indian and who is not. And in part, that's to distract from the fact that capitalism in India is in crisis and the environmental crisis in India is out of control. I mean, you look at New Delhi now, United Airlines won't even land there because the pollution is so rampant and so dangerous. So I do think that the kind of crises that we're seeing in Europe are both a sign of a crisis in capitalism, but that doesn't necessarily mean that something good is going to come of it. Something very, very bad indeed can come of that. And both Jason and I in Seven Cheap Things are good enough historians to observe that what follows capitalism may not be any better.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is cheap fuel necessary, Raj, to maintain capitalism?
Well, fuel is both a substitute for ornery workers. When workers start demanding things like rights, in the short term, those rights may need to be given. But in the medium and long term, the easy thing to do is just to get rid of the workers. If you're a factory owner, mechanizing is a way both of solving the headache of dealing with workers, but also of increasing your profits. But in order to do that, you need cheap energy. And again, the story of Madeira points to the fact that you couldn't have cheap sugar. You couldn't have this sugar complex without cheap energy. But the first cheap energy wasn't coal. It was wood. It's an ongoing, the second important thing that workers were spending their money on after they spent money on food through the 19th century, the second important thing was fuel. And so, again, stopping workers rising up in anger meant making sure that you had a supply of good, cheap fuel. And that both of those things are, you know, sort of important inserts into the standard operation of capitalism. And if you and now, of course, what we're seeing is while oil is, oil prices are hovering at around $50 a barrel, we're seeing the cost of getting that oil out of the ground going higher and higher. But that price is also made possible by government loans. And the real cost of oil, of course, is one that doesn't feature in any of those bottom lines, because we're living through the sixth extinction. We're living through climate change. And the cost of that never features in the cost of a gallon at the pump.
You have this really stark statement. I want to ask you a question about it. Why do most of us find it easier to visualize the end of life on the planet than we do to visualize the end of capitalism?
Well, because, you know, we see the end of life on the planet all the time. You know, we go to the movies, we go to, and in a sense, you know, we see its augurs around us already. We see, the signs of what that might look like. We see homelessness, we see poverty, we see social strife, we see, and particularly living in Texas. I mean, we all experience Harvey one way or another. It was very interesting. I was talking to some students who I was asking them, so what was it like to experience a hurricane? And they said, well, we didn't really experience it because we were evacuated out. But that's it, isn't it? You're evacuated out. That experience is also an experience of climate change. And that sort of perturbation of our lives, we experience those kinds of things all the time. And the kinds of dystopia that we see in the movies are ways in which we are taught to imagine the end of the world. But how are we taught to imagine what comes after capitalism? The only thing that we get to see occasionally is, the dodgy Russians on television. And we somehow associate that with, they're some sort of crypto-communists, and therefore that's what it must be like for capitalism to end. And I can't think that big. But that's precisely it. I think we live in a society that encourages us systematically to think small, to think that if we buy the right thing at the store, if we just buy organic and shade-grown and child-friendly, that we are in some way contributing to mending a relationship with the earth. But we're never given leave to dream cosmically big thoughts. And those are the kinds of thoughts that we need to be able to imagine a life after capitalism. And since none of us really get a chance to do that, it's much easier for us to just imagine that we're going to hell in a handbasket.
All right. After the break, we will talk about how to think our way to some of those big solutions. My guest is Raj Patel, research professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT and senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. His book is A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Raj Patel about the new book that he co-wrote with Jason W. Moore. It's called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. This book, we should clarify for people, is not some, a cleverly disguised new communist manifesto. It made me think, Raj, about the fact that at least in the U.S., we tend to think there is either capitalism or communism. We don't think a lot about the fact that there might be other ways of doing this.
Well, and thank you, Chris. I mean, I should rush to mention, the fact that we see capitalism coming to an end because of the profound ecological crises that are ahead. Neither Jason nor I are thrilled about that. We worry that the kinds of things that can come after that crisis, that crisis and the climate crisis and the associated crisis around food, for example, the fact that food prices are going to go up because we depend on cheap food coming from a stable climate, and we're ready to move into a very unstable period. We're not thrilled about that, but it's important, I think, for us to imagine differently. And, you know, the trouble is we don't get often to think those thoughts. I mean, you know, often, you know, for example, my kids are now in school here in Texas, and they're, you know, when they take the Pledge of Allegiance, they say things like, "One nation under God." And that's not accurate. In the United States, there are 562 federally recognized Indian nations. There are several nations in this country. And many of those nations have a relationship to the natural world, what we understand as the natural world, very different from our own. And so if one's thinking about cosmically big thoughts, one doesn't have to think about communism. And certainly one doesn't have to fall into the same kinds of Promethean ideas that it's humans at the top of the chain and then we can just use nature as we like. You don't have to make those mistakes again. There are other ways of imagining how we relate to one another and to the natural world that aren't about exploiting everything around us, but are in some way about negotiation and harmony. And that's what we sort of urge people towards the end of the book to think about, that in fact, if we're serious about transforming our relationship to nature and to the web of life in which we find ourselves, then it's not clear that 20th century communism is going to be the way to go.
Do we have to change our relationship to our definition, that is, of prosperity in order to make this work?
I think so. I mean, you know, and that's just because when we think of prosperity now, we think of money. And money is one of the cheap things. I mean, the story we tell of the sort of history of money is precisely it's the idea of cheap money is about a search for low interest rates so that frontiers can be expanded and then exploited and then expanded and exploited again. And it's not clear to me that having money or having a certain amount of a certain number of cars or a certain number of houses or whatever it is going to be the guide that we need to prosperity. And to measuring our prosperity. But there are ways that are about joy and happiness. Insofar as happiness studies is a thing on campuses these days, the ideas that come from those, from that sort of cluster of observations around human and social psychology are that the things that make us happy are about building communities together, about serving, about generosity, not about acquisition at all. And so, in a past book, I've said that the opposite of consumption isn't thrift, it's generosity. And if we're interested in moving away from this idea of prosperity, of just the stuff that you have, then moving away from that is not consuming less, but being generous.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Judy calling us from Dallas. Hi, Judy.
Hey, Chris, thanks.
Sure.
I was just curious. I heard a Wall Street Journal says the North Texas Dallas area is going to be the new headquarters for Amazon. Be careful what you wish for. What's that going to do for? I mean, this is crazy. This company is so huge, and it's going to turn everybody's life upside down.
I haven't seen that we actually received that, Judy, in the Wall Street Journal, but I know certainly Dallas is trying for that. But the spirit of the question remains, Raj.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, Jeff Bezos was we use Jeff Bezos as a way of saying, hey, you remember Christopher Columbus, and you remember that there's a big debate about, was Columbus the man who brought civilization to the Americas, or was he responsible for genocide? And the answer is he's both. But Jeff Bezos is the modern Christopher Columbus. He's not that he's genocidal, but he the kinds of as we were saying earlier on, the kinds of exploitation and work that are involved in Amazon fulfillment centers, they're the subjects of complaints from the National Labor Relations Board. In order for Alexa to fulfill your requests when you shout at her from the shower, she depends on the minerals that are extracted under conditions of modern-day slavery from places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. So it's not clear to me that the modern entrepreneurial heroes that we have are are different in kind from the kinds that Christopher Columbus was. And it seems to me that that kind of entrepreneurship, as I say, dependent on the exploration of space and in order to be able to expand the frontier, that doesn't seem to me to be a way of getting ourselves out of the profound ecological state shift that we're facing at the moment.
It's really easy, Raj, not to know or to pretend that we don't know that our decisions have an effect on the planet, right? Because when you and I walk into a gleaming Apple store and buy a new phone, there is nothing on the packaging that tells us about, the supply chain for those rare minerals, about the people who might have been exploited along the way. What obligation do we have to educate ourselves?
Well, Chris, in a sense, the idea that us going into an Apple store, that individually we should bear the full responsibility for knowing absolutely where everything comes from is an impossible task. The example I use with my students is this. Who has ever been confused about what to eat? All my students raise their hand. Have you ever found yourself in the supermarket holding two almost identical things and brought almost to tears by not being able to know which one is better? But that moment where you're like, well, I ought to be able to do the right thing, but I can't do the right thing. I'm faced with these two choices, and I can't tell the difference between them. What on earth am I meant to do? That's a moment in which you're internalizing the worst kinds of imperatives of ethical consumerism. And what I mean by that is just, look, you can't be someone who is omniscient about supply chains and omniscient about the nutritional benefits and omniscient about labor relations. It's in a sense, you're asking too much of yourself, and yet that's precisely what it is that you are being asked to do. You're being asked to be this omniscient ethical consumer and let your individual shopping decisions take some responsibility for the shape of the world. But as an individual, you can't do that. And that I think is one of the ideas that we're very keen on in this book, is to try and move us all away from thinking that individually we're going to solve this problem, that individually we are going to know exactly how well a particular company is behaving, or how well our favorite kind of quinoa is affecting the world. That's too much to ask. But what's not too much to ask is for us collectively, in organizations, in movements, to try and do things differently. And when we get together and when we organize in movements, then we can start to not only reasonably take responsibility for the shape of the world, but also start to do things about it. But as I say, as individuals, the minute someone says you're an individual consumer and you are free, they are lying to you. When you're in a supermarket, when you're in the Apple store, you're in one of the most curated and heavily studied environments on the planet. How can you take responsibility when everything about that environment is designed to beguile you? So it's not about taking responsibility as an individual when you shop. It's much more about taking responsibility as a citizen, as a person on this planet. And we can only do that collectively. So let's get to this idea of nature. If we're going to reframe our idea of a better relationship with nature, the first thing you shouldn't do is go out and hug a tree, right? You are not going to redefine humanity's relationship with nature by just embracing the nearest live oak. That would be a foolish way of doing things. There is an example that I really like. It's also about food. It's from the First Nations, the Haida community in what is it, the Pacific Northwest. And they have an amazing thing called the Salmon Festival, when the first salmon of the year swims up the stream and it's caught. And for 10 days, there's a celebration of this one salmon and the return of the salmon. And so for the rest of the time, in this 10 days, no one's allowed to fish. And that allows the salmon to regenerate and to spawn again. And that 10 days is spent celebrating the treaty between the Haida, between the coastal Salish people and the salmon people. And that's a very different way of thinking about humans and nature. Not as I get to exploit this because it's open season, but much more it's our treaty with these other kinds of living things. And that's something that we can't do individually. You can't make an individual treaty with a salmon, but you can collectively make a treaty with the salmon people. Now, you may say, well, all right, the salmon didn't have much to do with that. Where was the salmon signing the treaty? But it's a very different way of thinking about humans and the natural world as peers rather than as one exploiting the other. But you can only do that not when you buy ethical salmon, but when we reimagine what it is for us to be humans in a world on which we depend in the web of life.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Raj Patel. Raj, if we are to align the ways that we trade and govern and consume with sustainable practices, do we have to sweep aside that very highest echelon of individuals around the planet who have the most to gain from the system of capitalism that exists today?
It's very interesting to be reading, for example, The New Yorker about preppers. You've seen this stuff, right, Chris? Mm-hmm. The stuff that's about the billionaires who are preparing for the end times because they can see it coming and they can afford to be that paranoid, and they should be that paranoid, what we need to be doing is they're buying places in New Zealand and they've got their farms and they've got their bunkers and they're ready for the catastrophes that are about to come. But some of the more enlightened ones observe that, in fact, you can't just insulate yourself from the rest of humanity. That in fact their future is very much bound up with the rest of the planet. And so some of them, interestingly, are interested in exploring what alternatives that might look like a basic income grant, for example, or new ways of valuing work and the environment that aren't about the traditional kinds of sort of wage work and exploitation. So insofar as they are taking a lead in some of this thinking, some of this really big picture, cosmologically different thinking, I'm excited. But insofar as some of them are perpetuating the exploitation of workers and the planet and women's work and of care work and of people of color, then I do see them as a force for that's propelling us towards the sort of environmental and ecological catastrophe that is awaiting us in the latter part of the century.
Why are the rest of us who can't afford bunkers and doomsday preparations so eager to defend a system that is, it seems to be pushing us toward destruction?
In large part because I think our imaginations have been poisoned against dreaming other thoughts. And again, that's why Jason and I wrote this book, is to as an invitation to say, hey, you know what? If this is as good as it gets, surely our imaginations have been hampered a little bit because we're in the middle of the sixth extinction. We're about to destroy the very planet on which we depend. Surely we can imagine better than this. This is not all there is. This is not as good as it gets for most of us. And I think we've never been given that opportunity. We've always been told to swear allegiance to this particular economic system because the alternatives are always so much worse. But that's because we never had a hand in dreaming what those alternatives might be. And again, we can look to some of the First Nations, to some of the other human civilizations that have predated us and that continue to exist alongside us for better ideas about how it is that we might imagine this world and imagine our relationship to one another on it.
Are there places where this is already working? This kind of thinking is really affecting the way people live?
There was a really interesting study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a couple of years back, looking at the commons, looking at ways that First Nations and forest communities in particular were managing land. And what they observed was that if a community has enough land to recover from a catastrophe, so you need enough land to be able to insure yourself against the worst kinds of climate change, but if you were able to do that, and if you were able to govern the land by yourself, then in general, forest communities that had access to enough land and were given enough autonomy, enough freedom from the government and from the private sector, those communities did much, much better than if the government came in or if a corporation came in to manage the same land. Their levels of development were higher, levels of carbon sequestration were higher, levels of welfare were higher. So there are lots of people around the world who have much to teach us, and all we have to do is be ready to listen.
Raj Patel is research professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. His new book, written with Jason W. Moore, is A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Raj, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.